This is Sheila Bender, and you are listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today we have with us in the studio Maristone Island resident Michael Bushmull, who's here to talk to us about the many things that he does when it concerns the business of writing and of being effective in your writing. Michael teaches business writing and public speaking for clients around the world. He specializes in email, advertising copywriting, and speech writing. He's an author, book editor, cartoonist, media coach, and college instructor for Everett Community College, where he teaches business communications for Boeing. He is an editor for two blogs, one of which is promoting tourism in Africa. He is currently writing a book for women who will be running for political office on how to write campaign speeches and conduct media interviews. Michael and his wife recently moved to Maristone Island, so he's a newcomer here, and his background includes working in California hospitals, and he's also a former Catholic priest and monk. As an advertising copywriter and graphic artist and designer, he has lots of ideas to share with us about the visual aspects of writing. Wow, what a background, Michael. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here.
I can imagine that your background as a priest and a monk has informed the way you think about being effective in communication and the way you teach. Mm-hmm. So maybe we should start there.
Yes. I grew up in the Detroit area, finished high school, didn't know what to do, went to Wayne State University studying advertising art. So I've always been an artist. I got bored with that, and in 1960, I entered the seminary and studied to be a Roman Catholic priest. I joined a preaching order, so I started studying speaking. And over the years, I realized what I've done a lot of writing is I've written sermons. The last time I was a priest, right before Easter on Good Friday, I remember delivering 14 90-second sermons that I wrote carefully to commemorate the Stations of the Cross. So I think I got a speaking writing start that way.
And tell me about being a monk.
It's interesting. I was a monk, so we were in monasteries all over the Midwest. I was ordained in Chicago and then sent to California as a priest to work as a retreat master. So I'm used to running weekend religious seminars, which now I do not religious, but business communication seminars and workshops and teaching.
And now you are president of a company called Applause Associates. How does that work?
Well, I left the priesthood after a couple of years and married Charlotte, the woman who I met in California. And so I had to write to the Pope and say, I don't want to be a priest anymore. And I left the Catholic priesthood legally, and we've been married now for 47 years and raised two kids who are adults now. So after I left the priesthood, I walked the streets of San Francisco for 5 months looking for work. No one was hiring ex-priests. I was finally hired into an appropriate place, a psychiatric hospital. I worked there for a year. Then my wife and I ran a group home for emotionally disturbed teenagers, which all teenagers tend to be. And then I got a big job, 8 years, working in a Berkeley, California trauma hospital, where I learned how to become a trainer. And then I left there in 1981, moved to the Seattle area because we loved the Northwest, and I started a business, Applause Associates, with the idea of being that I could train people to speak and write and win applause with that.
It sounds like, I can see from your face, it's very gratifying work.
Yes.
And it is encompassing your training and your career history. Mm-hmm. So maybe we need more ex-priests getting jobs.
Well, a woman says to me once, she said, I'm glad you're not a priest anymore. Now you can help more people.
It's true.
So, I don't know if that's true, but you're certainly so.
Non-denominational now.
Yes.
So you have authored books that cover a wide territory. Some are helping executives, others are helping parents, and most of them are co-authored. So how have you found the people to write with and produce the books?
I've had a minor role in the sense that I've contributed to other books. I've helped out on a book on writing PowerPoint, so I contributed to that. I illustrated a book for a friend of mine who was a pediatrician in Seattle. She wrote a book called Prescriptions for Parenting, and I did like 93 cartoon illustrations for that. So that was that role. And beyond that, I simply have edited other people's books and helped them put their ideas into better words. So I haven't worked that much like co-author in an active sense, but more as a contributor to other people's stuff.
Mm-hmm. So you become knowledgeable about these topics as you're helping people, or
Well, I read voraciously. I read everything, every kind of field there is, from sports to music to cooking to international politics, everything. So I keep up with everything. I'm a voracious reader. I have dozens of websites I keep up with. So I'm informed about everything I can in the time that I have available.
And does that time include sleep?
Yes, it includes sleep. I actually get to sleep.
I'm glad to hear that. It's supposed to be very healthy to get good sleep.
Yeah.
Everything you tell me is so entertaining. Before we went on the air, you told me a little bit about working with blue-collar workers, being given funds to get training and towards degrees from Boeing, and that's the work you do at Everett.
Right.
Tell us about that a little bit.
Everett Community College has a program that Boeing sponsors. They pay for each employee who wants to get a degree to earn a promotion. And so there's a whole lot of classes on budgeting, on classes on lean management, all these things. I do three classes. One's called Executive Presentations, which is a 5 3-hour session. So it's 15 hours of classroom time. One called Dealing with Challenging Behavior. Another one is called Communicating with Impact. So those are classes that I do there. And they're a lot of fun. People are interested. They're motivated enough to be there. And if they don't show up, then they have to pay for the classes.
Oh.
So there is motivation that way.
So I can just see your history with the teenagers coming through with helping people to deal with challenging behavior in the workplace.
And
it would seem to me that as a professional coach in terms of making effective presentations, your classrooms are full of effective presentations.
Yes.
And are any of those materials written up?
What I've done is I haven't written any book, but what I do is I create printed handouts. Being an artist, my approach toward writing is it's both visual and content-wise. So I design every page. I'll spend 2 hours sometimes designing the cover for an 8.5 by 11 page booklet. And so I put all my effort into those booklets, and I have many of them because I've taught many things over the years. For example, I stopped teaching this because we moved to Marison Island, but I was teaching a class called Speak Better English for Non-Native Speakers for North Seattle College, and I had many au pairs in the class who were babysitting basically for Seattle families, and they wanted to speak better English. So I do a whole series just on that and many other topics, running meetings, for example, and so on.
How does one put this all together? This is all under your business name, Applause. But what kind of work do you do behind the scenes to find all these areas in which the people who can learn from you are going to presentations or schools?
Yeah, well, like I say, I keep reading. I was a member of ASTD, the American Society for Training and Development. So I really got a start in training way back in 1973. And I've just volunteered to teach for a lot of the community colleges. Everett, North Seattle, Green River, Highline, Bellevue College. I taught for 29 years there. And I just picked up all these things. In the year 2000, I gave a talk at Microsoft for Chinese workers. I forget what was on, but anyway, a woman in the group came up to me afterwards and said, "Would you teach for us in China?" So I made a mistake of saying yes. And beginning in 2001, I began going to China. I've been there now 28 times. In China, I have taught a whole MBA communications course, 30 classroom hours. And part of that was teaching Chinese people how to write research papers in English, which they had never done. And then I had to correct them. And boy, was that a burden when I first got a hold of them, because their English is different from ours. They don't have plurals. They don't use articles like and, so on. They don't have tenses like, "I went to the store." They'd say, "I go to the store yesterday." So I realize I can't turn these into proper English. I've got to accept their ideas as they are and let that slip, because I've taught more than 1,000 people in China, including all airlines, because Boeing paid for some of those classes. So anyway, I've been pushed into a whole lot of things. I'll read, I'll study about things, try them out in classes, and they seem to fly.
That's interesting. And also what's interesting is about our language, English. Even though that sentence structure that you gave us, that was how a Chinese person would translate into English, it's completely understandable.
Sure.
So that's an interesting thing about our language, is how malleable it really is, how much we can still understand, even if it isn't the exact English that we were taught to write. So you sent me a quote by email that I have fallen in love with. Having heard the first part often from other writers, I had never heard the second part. And this is from Cheryl Strayed. "I write to find out what I have to say. I edit to figure out how to say it right." Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. There's a management author named Russell Ackoff. I found a book that he wrote one time. He described a lecture he gave to teachers, and he said this. He said, "We learn more by talking than by listening." And his thought was, we don't really know what we think until we try to say it. And to me, the same idea applies to writing. Once you start writing, ideas will come at you from everywhere. I knew a novelist who was writing a novel in Washington, D.C. She wrote to me and she said, a male character entered this novel and completely took over the novel. She also made a funny comment about living in Washington, D.C. during the summer. She said, living in Washington, D.C. is like spending the summer in the open mouth of a dog. Was her description of the heat, humidity, and smell. But anyway, we learn by producing things. It's kind of like probably the smartest short phrase ever is, we learn what we do. And when we're actually writing, not just reading about writing, ideas will come to us. It'll go in different directions and so on.
Absolutely. Sometimes we're afraid of the ideas that come.
Yes.
Have you coached people through that difficulty?
We're afraid because, as you know well, on our shoulders, like dandruff, is a critic, right? Our conscience. So we write a sentence and we make judgment. Is this said the right way? What will other people say if they read this? Will I be criticized, judged, or whatever? So there's that kind of fear also. Sometimes it's fear of success. But I love a quotation by a novelist who said, writing is an unnatural act. It should be performed in private, and you should wash your hands afterwards. So it's not easy. On the other hand, it's interesting. There's a saying, the world is ruled by syllables. And if you think about the way the world runs, it's almost all dictated by what are in books. The Bible, the Quran, even this government, our country, it's the Constitution. Words in print control the world. These are expressions of human beings. That's all they are. But yet we bow to them and we follow them and so on. We fight for them. Another line I love is, a novel is nothing but a dictionary out of order.
You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend. In case you just joined us, you are listening to In Conversation with Sheila Bender, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today, Sheila is talking with Marrowstone Island's Michael Bushmole about writing tips and his career in helping writers create and edit effective email, speeches, blogs, and more.
That brings me to a quote that you also shared with me from Sister Carita Kent's 10 Rules for Artists. Consider everything an experiment. So I think that's hard for people in writing because when you take exams in college, especially the written exams, you have a certain amount of time and it's not an experiment. You better tell the information that the teacher is looking for.
Yeah, you do the best you can.
How do we shift then as people who are educated to this idea for creative writing especially, but maybe even at one stage in business writing, to the place where we are writing to find out what we have to say, and by doing, we're finding the act of writing is the doing, we're finding what we have to say, but it's an experiment. How do we put that together?
Yeah, good question. I don't know all the answer, but I do have one overarching approach toward writing. It really comes down to one document that many of us create during our lifetime, and that is a love letter. To me, if all writing was considered an act of love, like a love letter, we'd all be better writers. Today, we have this thing called social media, which in my opinion has become unsocial media, the way people attack and criticize and so on. Love letter, for example, you would never use these words, many of you, all of you, or some of you. I have three tips about writing email. I'll share them with you right now. My first tip has to do with love letters. If you're writing a love letter, you wouldn't say many of you, all of you, or some of you, because reading is an act performed by individuals, one person at a time. You can't really write to groups. Groups don't read. Individuals do. Therefore, I would say, I would never begin any document, dear friends. Friends don't read. It's dear friend, dear colleague, dear council member. And to teachers, I say, when you send things home with kids, don't write dear parents. Write dear parent. And in many families, there's only one parent anyway. So you're always writing to one. Even if 1,000 people read it, they read it as an individual. So that's my first big point about writing. Think of it as connecting with one person who's reading what you write. Therefore, for example, an email, I'd never write hi all. All doesn't read. Just write hi or good morning or something like that. My second tip is the way you achieve it, and that is In the first sentence of everything you write, try this. Include the word you or the word your, Y-O-U-R, in sentence one of everything you write, and you will instantly be a better writer because that's the one word that connects with that one reader. I'll give you five quick examples. You can begin any document with thank you. Thank you has the word in it, or thanks for your something. Second, you want something from the reader? You could ask, I have a favor to ask you, or I have a special favor to ask you. Third, sometimes I'll start by typing the word you or your as my first word, which forces me to talk to the reader like this. You asked when my budget would be ready, or your comment in yesterday's meeting surprised me. For cover letters to go with a resume, two lines. Your ad on the internet caught my eye, or I was excited to see your ad for a. And finally, for long documents, you could start like this. In this report, you will find. Now, the word you I'm referring to is the friendly, everyday use of the word you, not the negative use, like, what's wrong with you? You are an idiot, or you must do this. No, it's just the friendly. What's happened, I've gotten feedback from many people, that when they do this, when they connect with the reader in the first sentence, they get responses, and sometimes they make more sales, which I've had that report. So you've got one reader, connect with the word you, and I use it as a creative challenge to get the word you into the first sentence of everything. My third tip is try to get your email message within the first three sentences of your email. Think of the first three sentences like prime real estate. You can use the rest of the email to explain, justify, or use an attachment. Now, what is your message? I look at it this way. There's only two messages. We write either to tell or to ask. If we're telling, that means we have information, we want the reader to get it, like an announcement, a policy, an update, an explanation. It's FYI, for your information. Or we write to ask. We want the reader to do something, like answer a question, send us something, take some physical action. The sooner the reader knows what you want, the sooner the reader can respond. Now, I've got a funny example I often use. How to get your message across in only two sentences. But to do this, you have to use your imagination. This is all pretend. Pretend you work with someone you don't like. This person is your enemy. Here's how to write to that person. First sentence, I have a favor to ask you. Second sentence, would you seek employment elsewhere? I'm kidding. So my three tips are, you've got one reader, connect with the word you in the first sentence, get your message across in the first three sentences. One, you, three.
One, you, three.
Yep.
Repeat that for me then. Give me the example. One is use, the first sentence is you.
Walk right to one individual, not to groups.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Second, begin documents with the word you in the first sentence or the word your,
right,
which connects with that one reader. And try to get your message, the third thing, is within the first three sentences. Get your message up front. Just as books have abstracts, for example. Executives like executive summaries that you put at the top of a document. People are busy. They don't have a lot of time to reach the bottom of an essay, let's say, to find out what is it you want.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to be done. And in an age of Twitter and instant messages, we have to write shorter anyway.
But your tips are valuable for longer writing, too.
Yes.
And have you had writers who are writing stories or poems or creative style writing come and use your tips?
Yes, some of those tips would apply to the same kind of thing. I really love poetry. I've read many books on poetry and studied. I find it a fascinating thing, the essence, the art of poetry, the business of rhyming. What's nice about poets is poets create images. There's an actor, Peter Coyote, who said that we hear in images. And poets are the best ones who do this. And from the images they write, we get two things. We get feelings and we get ideas that come from the words themselves. I also love this technique where people are writing stories in six words, that which has become a popular thing. For example, the famous one by Hemingway, for sale, baby shoes, never worn. Or a line from, I think it's Johnny Cash, every morning with her having coffee.
Ah, that's lovely.
There's a lot of, it's amazing what can be said in a very short time.
There's actually a site online that accepts these stories. It's called Six Words.
Six Words, okay.
Yeah. And you can read a lot of them there, plus make up your own and send them
in.
Writing short is a talent, and I think a lot of us have listened in our lifetimes to a lot of, let's say, blustery sort of lecturers, and we have the idea that in order to be a writer, in order to sound smart, in order to be listened to, we have to use a lot of abstract words.
Yes.
We have to summarize. Mm-hmm. We have to add phrases that are necessary.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard to break that habit.
Yes.
So I like the way you're giving us these tips, 1, 2, 3, do this, things get better.
Yes, and let me comment on that, what you just said. When I'm teaching presentation skills, I will ask a class, how many of you are good writers? How many of you like to write? Hands go up. Well, there's a problem with writing and speaking. Writers tend to use longer sentences and bigger words. Speaking needs to be the opposite. John Caples, a great advertising copywriter, once said, the most powerful words in the world are always simple words, the words that everyone understands. So sometimes when you're trying to look erudite and smart, we'll use words that, well, they may make you look more like you're showing off or something. But nobody is offended by simple language. Even Shakespeare's line, to be or not to be, the longest word in that line is only 3 letters long, the word not. A lot can be said with very simple words.
Right. When I was studying poetry, at first I remember the teacher saying, your Anglo-Saxon words are going to be the best words to use because they are the words that hold images that are not fancified. And they have to be careful with the Latinate words. Mm-hmm. They often lead to summary.
Yes.
Which isn't using the image. It's moving over into that other land. But to have the flexibility to know when to use what kind of diction is really important.
Yeah.
But if you are steering away from words that include images, you're making it harder for the person listening to absorb
exactly
what you're saying because it doesn't seem attached to something tangible.
Yes. I use this example about using what I call picture words. A picture word is a word that if you had one in the room, people could walk up and touch it, or they could see it with their eyes. And I use this example. A fire chief goes to a school gymnasium to talk to kids. His opening sentence is this, today I'd like to tell you a sad story about a boy, a puppy, and a box of matches. Compare that to a typical firefighter's opening sentence. Today I'd like to talk to you about fire safety. In the first sentence, any kid in the room could have walked up and touched a boy, a puppy, or a box of matches, but no one could have touched safety. Even though it's a common everyday word, it's not a real thing. It's a set of ideas and concepts. And when we speak in abstractions, it's like trying to stick Jell-O to a plate glass window. We need Velcro words that snag attention and stick in the mind. And that's what picture words, and that's what poets do best, I think, of all writers.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to tell you a little story from when I was in graduate school. I was in writing. However, I had to take a critical theory class, and the class was divided up, had to choose novels in the postmodern era, and then present a seminar. So somebody chose Faulkner's The Sound and the Fury, and he opened his seminar by asking us to go around the room and talk about the pleasure of the text. People were saying their pleasure of the text was that it had so many layers, it was like an onion, you could keep peeling it. And it got to me, and I was the only poet in the class, and I said, for me, the pleasure of the text was all that mud at the opening when the grandfather comes storming in his carriage and his horses splash mud on little Maddie's white toddler clothes. And they all put their hands over their mouths and were like trying to keep the laughter in because this was definitely not graduate school level. But I was really exercising what I learned with the poets, which yes. is if you don't have something like the puppy and the matches and the boy, mm-hmm. and you don't have anything.
Yes.
Because we learn through story mm-hmm. and we attach ourselves to the plot mm-hmm. and to the information. Mm-hmm. And I will go away always thinking about fire safety equals mm-hmm. boy and puppy and matches. Mm-hmm. And you know what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. It's sometimes for some people a hard lesson because I think that you're being silly if you're being specific.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, if without specifics, nothing's very interesting.
Yeah. I have a storytelling formula I'd like to share with you. I learned this from a woman from Los Angeles. She was in a class I taught. She said she learned it in school, but I've never seen this format in any book on storytelling, and I've read a lot of them. It's 4 words, somebody, wanted, but, so. So every story has those elements. There's always a somebody, which is the main character. Could be a man, woman, child, animal, or a group of people. And this somebody is living at a certain time, and they're in a certain condition. It could be the 1920s in the United States, or the person could be crying, or whatever. So you've got a somebody established. Next, wanted. What was this person or group seeking, desiring, yearning for, struggling for? Third word, but. What obstacle did they face? What problem? What challenge? What conflict? And finally, so. So what did they learn? What did they do? What happened? Somebody wanted, but so.
All right, so give us that string of words again. Somebody.
Somebody wanted, but so.
That's good. There's a lot of work written about plot points and obstacles and how the protagonist has to...
Right, and the hero approach and all that.
Yeah, right. And so it's easier to remember mm-hmm. what you just said. Somebody wanted
but so.
All right.
Yeah.
And even in managerial writing or even in emails, can we do this?
Yes. I teach that story technique in the managerial because let's say you're trying to sell your budget. You could use a story format to pat yourself on the back. I'll use a Boeing example. Let's say that somebody is an airline leasing company. They want to get 30 new planes that they can lease to customers, but they were not able to work out a program with anyone. We took our staff of salespeople, we negotiated a contract, and today they fly 30 of our 777s.
Okay, it works.
Yeah.
It works. Well, we have a few more minutes left. Is there anything that you want to leave the listeners with?
I want to share one of my actual favorite editing tips, which is this. Whenever you create a sentence, you've got a beginning, a middle, and an end of any long sentence. Where do you put your biggest idea in the sentence? You always put it at the end. Emphasis is always at the end. In fact, the last word of any sentence has the most potential impact, or among the final words. I'll give you two examples. Two actresses have said this in movies. Katharine Hepburn and Grace Kelly in separate movies use this line. The time to make up your mind about people is never. It all comes down to that final word. The time to make up your mind about people is never.
What a beautiful way to end our program because that says so much. It's so rich, not only about the editing tip, but about how you have to be open as a writer.
Yes.
And the experiment part that we talked about. I want to thank you so much for coming in today. It's really lovely to talk with you.
A great pleasure to talk with you, too. Thank you.
In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman. Thank you.